So my presentation has a very simple structure. What does that personal data marketplace look like? How did we get there? How much is your personal data worth? And perhaps what we can do about it. Just by way of a little bit of background, Web X-Ray is a privacy forensics consultancy run by me and my business partner, Tim Lieber, who's also an academic at Carnegie Mellon University in the US. And privacy forensics is a sort of emergent field that we are part of that involves studying the actual forensic data transactions between us and the ad tech companies. So, first of all, what does that marketplace look like? Well, I'd like to give a quick shout out to a previous speaker at Privacy Week, Peter Pergetolfer. And he last year gave an excellent overview of one of the biggest areas of concern when it comes to ad tech and tracking, which is that it leads to lower quality journalism and it creates an economy for fake news. But I'm just going to be talking about the way in which that data is actually monetized in particular. So in 2010, this is a super graphic, if you will, of the ad tech market as it was then. It's produced by a consultancy called Luma Partners. And in 2018, they produced a similar graphic. And as you can see, that industry has grown somewhat. In fact, you probably can't even see all of the companies that are featured on this graphic anymore. And all of these different boxes represent niche fields of technology that involve transacting on our personal data. What is a data broker? Axiom is a typical data broker and one of the largest data brokering companies. And another Privacy Week speaker, I think, has given an excellent talk on this in the past, Wolfie Crystal, I think an Austrian. And we talk a lot of the time about the way in which we should be concerned by the larger players in technology, typically Google and Facebook. But we don't talk for very long about the companies that we don't really know, that we don't see, that don't present themselves to us in the form of logos. And that's because they're business-to-business companies. And while the practices of these businesses are less well-publicized, they have a very close, direct relationship, in particular to people's financial futures. So Wolfie produced a good overview of simply what these different data brokers state about the sheer numbers and the amount of data points they collect on individuals. And as you can see, you know, we look at the top companies that we're aware of, Facebook, Google, and Apple, but Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, Axiom, Oracle, all have very comparable figures. We're still talking about, you know, credit data on 918 million people in the case of Experian. The smaller data brokers clearly collect as much personal data as the major players, especially when you add them all together. And what do they do with that data? Well, they segment it and they make it available for brands in order so that they can target us with advertising. And different variations on these profiles offer different value to different companies, of course. And they are sold in pseudo-anonymous batches. So this is a segmentation created by Experian, which is actually a company that I used to work for once upon a time. That's where I started my career. And as you can see, they arrange these categories based on their idea of your relative financial affluence. So, for example, they describe people in batches like high flyers or inner city high flyers or bank of mum and dad, as in people that still rely on their parents for financing. And people wonder why marketers are so hated in most industries. And the way in which they collect personal data from us varies, but mostly it is through themselves being present on apps, websites, and services that we use. So a major driver of knowledge for these organizations is the tracking they place on websites that we visit. And I presume that to some extent you're aware of all of this. You're attending a conference called Privacy Week. So I can move on to the particularities of how that happens quite directly. This visualization here is the result of a scan undertaken with our software, Web X-Ray. And this is comparing the tracking that is going on a subscription-based news website, the Financial Times, the FT, with The Guardian. And as you can see, when you visit The Guardian, there's a long list of companies that you've probably never heard of, where your data is being sent, where your visit is being sent, where all the metadata associated with your visit is being sent, the repeated visits you have to a particular topic. And of course, it's no surprise that publishers go along with this very willingly. Publishers have always had a close relationship to the advertising community since static and print advertising. Why wouldn't they? But in the 21st century, it means they have a very different relationship to their readers. And The Guardian certainly has a different relationship with its readers than the FT. But this also operates in areas of websites that you would perhaps be surprised by. So for example, the New York Times versus Pornhub. You would be surprised perhaps to learn that on the basis of user tracking, you're better off going to Pornhub. Some of you may say you're better off going to Pornhub anyway, for other reasons. But I mean, most consumers are aware to some degree. They see the ads, they know they're paying for their visit by seeing the advertising, they're paying with their eyeballs. But of course, it doesn't take a genius to realize that occasionally the websites you visit may reveal very sensitive things about you. And if these trackers are invisible, and this is tied to a profile that can be de-identified, then this is a transaction that's going on ultimately without your consent. And these relationships these days are not simply one way in the way that they used to be when it comes to publishers and advertisers. So for example, the Daily Mail, many of you will be familiar with the publication that has contributed to the destruction of the politics of my country. Of course, it goes without saying, it is crawling with trackers. Depending on when you visit it, you can get anything between 20 to 100, as we discover with Web X-Ray. But I was surprised to find that Taboola, which is one of the tracking companies that displays content-based advertising along the bottom of an article, so displaying something along the lines of more from around the web, as if we needed more. As it turns out, the Daily Mail actually is a shareholder in that company itself. So there's a two-way relationship there and a mutually beneficial relationship. And when you start investigating these corporate relationships, a bigger picture starts to emerge. And it's also not always consistent with, you know, the business models that you'd expect to befit publishers. So this is a website called The Canary. It's a very left-wing journal in the United Kingdom, very pro-Labour Party, pro-socialism, pro-democracy. And you would think that they would be not particularly enthusiastic about this sort of capitalism. But when you get into it, when you scan with the Web X-Ray, you find that it actually reveals the company to be collecting data on you for around 112 different tracking companies. And this information, as I said, can be very, very sensitive. You know, do they collect and sell information about my personal health? Yes, and yes. So if you visit a government health website, you've got a couple of different trackers running on there that mostly exist in a functional way so that the webmaster can actually understand the website that they're delivering. But if you visit a search result from WebMD, then you can see that it's informing a large number of companies about the health conditions that you're personally researching. And my business partner, Tim Liebert, studied WebMD in 2015 and released a paper on it demonstrating how WebMD directly sold data on individuals that health insurers could buy in the US. And of course, simply because this collection is passive, they've collected this information from EU citizens for many, many years as well. And this data is segmented and sold. When you scroll through, you'll start to see that the conditions become increasingly sensitive, that people are giving away information about their bodily functions, whether it's their sinuses or their reproductive health, and being categorized potentially to pharmaceutical companies, who would be the obvious buyer for this sort of market. And I think, given that this is largely invisible, this would be disturbing to many website visitors if they knew. This is from a fairly major ad tech company called The Trade Desk. And this is a publicly available document. This is just simply one of the PDFs you can get from one of their websites about their health segments. So why do they do this? Well, data brokers create value by claiming to have the largest possible number of data points on a given individual. The more data points, the more valuable the profile. And the more individuals with the most data points, the more valuable the overall data set. Companies such as Experian or Criteo have grown as a result of these data sets and their ability to provide access to other service providers who can benefit from that ability. And in particular, Experian were able to do this because they are already one of the largest credit checking agencies in the world, not just in the US, also in the UK, also around Europe. And their role as a credit checking agency gives them legal entitlement to collect as much data from individuals as possible. And of course, it's obvious that they would do this because people that incur a lot of debt pose a risk to the global financial system. And of course, Experian have done a phenomenal job of ensuring that the global financial system has never gone wrong in any way. We've all been protected from this debt. But preventing risky debtors was never really their focus. Instead, they've built an enterprise selling data on customers which still dominates today and is also shared by much smaller companies. So whilst it is true that Google performs the largest amount of tracking compared to any other company, Google is not particularly typical in the industry in the sense that it provides a huge amount of customer-facing services that we all know and we all use. Well, perhaps not all of us, but many of us use. And in terms of regulation, Google poses quite an extreme challenge because of the sheer dependency that the world has on Google's infrastructure. But other companies are different, and the archetype of this industry is companies that provide very few business-to-customer services, and instead simply collect that data through back doors from other enterprises. And if you think about it, of course, it makes sense. Providing actual services which justify that collection is quite a headache. It's quite resource intensive. It requires costly ingenuity, and it's a risk. Why spend precious capital on this when you can just operate as a business-to-business company, get a back door into every other business-to-customer company, and instead profit from that segmentation by passing on that customer data and selling it to other third parties? And of course, this is used in a political context at the same time. Experian holds a service called Audience IQ, which, as they say in their own words, influence voting behavior by interweaving demographic, psychographic, and attitudinal characteristics. And they claim to hold this sort of data on over a billion people. And they earned over $4.6 billion in revenue last year. And in the example that I'm giving you here, this is the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. I'm not singling them out for any reason, but this is a self-proclaimed anti-capitalist party. And as you can see in the run-up to previous elections, they are spending a lot of money acquiring data from Experian in order to make their advertising more effective, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of pounds in the run-up to an election. So it's certainly a question as to whether this business model is a threat to our democracy, at the very least. And other ad tech companies, of which I would bundle Facebook in there, also are looking to participate in the credit scoring industry as well, and vice versa. Facebook caused a lot of scares when it applied for a patent in 2015 to work to aggregate credit scores using social media data. But if you pay attention to Google patents, which I recommend that you do, because it offers a good insight as to innovation in the majority of the tech industry, there are patents floated and signed for this sort of reconciliation all the time. And it's clear that there's a consensus forming in the financial industry and in the credit industry that social media data is entirely fair game to enhance people's profiles and to eliminate risk. In this case, the patent says that credit is based on often flawed data reported to credit bureaus relating to limited financial factors such as historical payment history and credit utilization. And the source of this data is lenders who report data then is archived in the credit bureau databases. And the fundamental problem they have is that it's largely self-reported data. So why not collect data that people aren't aware they are reporting in order to eliminate financial risk? Other companies have tried to innovate in other ways with this collection. A company called Visual DNA harnesses the power of psychology to focus on so-called credit intent. They produce quizzes that allow them to inform credit profiles on the basis of just what sort of decision-making you do, how you behave, how you approach financial questions. And a wider problem this quote illustrates is that these companies are aggregating data sets at a speed and a scale that we can't see. They say very proudly in one of their publications that our vision is to create a bureau of intent data that sits alongside credit information. We have a strategic relationship with Experian and other credit bureaus around the world, and they have integrated another company's data set, CoolCredit. But are all of the customers of CoolCredit aware that their credit data is now integrated with this other company that they've never heard of? No, I'm assuming they weren't informed. And Visual DNA also integrates the data of MasterCard and Experian alongside insurance companies such as Admiral. And this is what Wolfie Crystal called networks of corporate surveillance. But I actually prefer just to use their own lingo in the industry, which is consistent with the time that I also worked in this industry. And they call it something very mundane. They simply call it partner integrations, which sounds very benign. But I think it's always a helpful rule of thumb when investigating any of these industries to really learn their own lingo, because they're not going to call what they do networks of corporate surveillance. You know, every industry has its own lingo, and it's really helpful to pick it up if you want to find clues as to what's going on. So how did we get here? Well, the ad tech industry is obviously omnipresent. It makes money from the detail of these profiles, and it collects data from users on domains who are not themselves funded by ads in the same way the publishers are. So government websites, hospitals, insurance, legal websites, essential services that often list information that is a service to consumers and often a government-funded service, have unknowingly created backdoors for their pages to ad tech. It's as simple as adding a share this button to a page, which of course when Web 2.0 came along, became a necessity on a web page for it to appear modern. And the flexibility of HTML is that you can include elements on a page that you are not yourself hosting. So the way in which they can collect information about the users is as mundane as a HTTP request, which is when the content is hosted on another server and you're viewing the page and your browser is requesting that content. But the URL of the page you're visiting is contained in that transaction. And if that URL contains .. sensitive health information here, as it does, for example, on WebMD, then that third-party company is learning a lot about you. Other ways that trackers get in? Nearly every enterprise that is B2C has a sales arm. And what normally happens, I'm sure many of you have worked in companies where this operates, some very clever person decides we're going to integrate all of our information on our customers between sales and marketing into a CRM, into a customer relationship management database. And what happens is they then build the website off the back of this, especially if it's a customer-facing website. And they will go on a template marketplace. And something like HubSpot or Salesforce, maybe companies that you're familiar with this. And many of these templates will contain third-party tracking scripts. And of course, you know, the director of marketing is not thinking about this, is not concerned about this as they're picking the template. They're thinking, which one looks the nicest? Which one's going to get my message across? Which one is going to be the easiest to maintain? And this scenario means that there can even be malware instances in these templates that control all of this customer data. There's always a potential for a backdoor, and these things are very rarely screened. So it's similar to a sort of Trojan horse model. Now, of course, we're all familiar with consent management platforms, which have occurred since GDPR, where we get these fantastically annoying messages that give us a choice as to whether we would like to consent to 100 companies tracking us on a page, and no choice if we don't. And a study was conducted by PageFair at the end of 2017 before the legislation was going to be implemented as to how many would accept tracking from third parties, given a clear choice. And the study noted that only 20% of people would be happy for their data to be shared with third parties for advertising purposes. But this approach strikes me as a little odd, because why would a company choose a response to GDPR which involves a horrendous user experience? I mean, I think everyone agrees that this is a very annoying thing to have to do when you're researching anything or trying to gain information. It's a reason to leave a website. And if you don't have adequate choice when you visit a website, then it's essentially meaningless. Why even present us with this choice? So I would say they're not even a sticking plaster when it comes to this problem. But consent is not the only problem. It's also a supply chain issue. And third parties just operate via backdoors, as I said with that example with the CRM. But the way in which it's viewed within the industry and the technology industry in general is that privacy is up to you. It's about how secure you want to make your own personal browsing experience. And I don't believe that's the way in which they should be viewing it. I mean, if we applied the same analogy to banks, you are responsible for your own security when you go in and visit a cash point. We visit very few banks, I think. And the other thing is that many of these approaches are not strictly speaking GDPR compliant either. Tracking walls are themselves prohibited under Article 7 of the GDPR. The way in which I think it needs to be viewed is that a privacy breach on a website that is non-consensual is essentially the same as a security failure. And most of the time, it can amount to the same thing. It's not a customer's responsibility when visiting these websites. And I think it needs to move towards an enterprise responsibility. And it becomes a bit of an arms race, because everyone has heard of cookies by now. And in the advertising industry, they've been talking for a long time about the death of the cookie. But that's okay, because they have so many other ways of gathering data points on you, and you will never be able to keep up. Why would you be able to keep up? You're a single individual going about your life. How can you possibly compete with a $100 billion industry that wants to collect 1,000 data points on you? Browser fingerprinting, tracking pixels, all of these things, we discover them, but we will never win the race as individuals. One example, Facebook and Google demonstrate that it will always be easier for ad tech to work offensively than consumers to work defensively. In 2017, as part of a successful marketing campaign on privacy, Apple announced that they would prevent tracking and block third-party cookies on their Safari browser. And if you were a Mac user, then maybe you celebrated and you were slightly gullible and naive. Facebook just simply started rolling out first-party cookies that the browser would allow, but these first-party cookies were able to transfer identifiers to their tracking pixels. So the whole system was very, very quickly circumvented immediately, and that information is then simply sent back to corroborate that same data back to Facebook. So how much is my data worth? Well, it's hard to know. And of course, your data is worth different amounts to different companies, depending on whether you're relevant to them. A pair of US senators this summer pitched a bill called the Dashboard Act in order to force companies to directly answer that question and disclose any contracts with third-party data collectors and disclose their value as well. I think it is hopeful that something similar to this will get through, but I think it's unlikely that such a bill will pass unamended. As you can imagine, with a $100 billion industry, they have considerable lobbying power. And I think when a bill is being proposed, it's very tempting for us to feel the ideal situation is possible. But actually, the idea that all of those requirements will be the shape of the bill when it actually comes out is very unlikely. Other people have tried to find out for themselves how much their personal data is worth. Federico Zanier decided to sell his data for $2 a day using Kickstarter. In the end, he made $2,733, which is quite impressive. Recode tried to estimate it by simply calculating all the digital advertising revenue in the US by the adult population, and worked out that an ad-free internet would cost every single US adult about $35 a month. But even though the Dashboard Act is yet to be signed into law, there are already mechanisms that enable you to make money off your personal data. Sadly, they're largely run by data brokers themselves, which you might say is appropriate given that they're the ones making money, but it also means that they're actually giving you an incentive to give them more data. So SRAX, an ad tech firm, which offers mostly just business-to-business services, offers a tool called BigToken where you can trust them with all of your social media accounts, and they will then sell your data online to other data brokers, giving you the opportunity to earn points, like a reward scheme. I'd rather eat poison myself. Reddit users, and of course there's a Reddit subthread devoted to beer money, where you can make money doing this sort of thing. They claim that you can earn up to $5 a day from it, which is a very exciting opportunity. I think all of these all of these are just really stunts at this point. There's a student, Sean Buckles, in the Netherlands. He managed to earn 350 euros selling his data to the Next Web. But all of these are not really representative of the relationship that we have with data brokers. The fact is that the value of your data really depends on what segment you're in. High net worth individuals are, of course, often worth more to advertisers than non-super yacht owners like myself, and perhaps you. And I think depending on the product that they're trying to sell to you, you may want to be targeting 2,000 high flyers within a particular wealthy geography, and you're going to pay more as a brand to access that high value data set with your advertising. And the truth is, you just don't get to judge your own value to an advertiser. So your value will always fluctuate. You have a lifetime value, though. That's called a customer life cycle. And the ad tech companies are incentivized to increase your lifetime value to the brands. Frequently, their job is actually to overstate that. But personally, I wouldn't think it is worth taking control of these initiatives to make $5 a day these days. So, what can we actually do about it? Well, the GDPR came in, and it has some very pertinent articles relating to the sale of your personal data and the processing of your personal data. So there is, of course, a detailed set of compliance requirements for data brokers these days. Whether there's the visibility on their compliance, whether governments have equipped national regulators with the resources, with the time, with the budget to staff the detection of all of these breaches of non-compliance is a very different matter, of course. Every single data protection agency in the EU can only handle a certain caseload. And we have to remember, we're talking about offices with between 15 to 50 people. The UK, my home country, has one of the largest offices with the data protection agency, the ICO, and they have a severe limit on their caseload. So ultimately, we've got to get to a place of enterprise responsibility. But what can we do? And by we, I mean Web X-ray, as privacy forensic specialists. Well, we can actually start getting some visibility on this situation at the very least. So there are people that study the marketing technology companies and the advertising technology companies very well. And something that we have to pay attention to is market consolidation, because as these companies take over each other, they of course merge and share data sets. And you can always consent to a first party relationship with a provider, but if they're acquired by another company, then you have to realize that that new company includes all of the data from the company you had that relationship with. On the one hand, ad tech and marketing tech are so big as industries that they're not actually hugely consolidated. There's a lot of tiny companies there as well. You sort of have the worst of both worlds. You have a lot of huge multinationals with very little transparency and tiny companies that no one has heard of with a lot of sensitive information, because it's so cheap to collect this data from individuals. And what I like to do is to actually scrutinize the ownership of the companies using my own training. I'm a former anti-money laundering investigator, and my job and my role within the company is to ensure that we have accurate information on the companies and their relationships. This is a complex area of mapping, which I've prototyped an automated methodology for. And we now actually have Horizon 2020 funding to roll out this methodology. And it's unfortunately, it can be a very tedious methodology. You have to start reading the accounts of the companies, because a lot of the time they are not based where they say they are based. So for example, AppNexus is a medium-sized data broker. It's still present on around 20% of the web. And you know, as you can see in their account filings, they're perceived to be a company that's based in the United Kingdom, but actually their ultimate owner is a company based in Delaware. And in Delaware, you cannot retrieve corporate records in the same way. In the UK, you can retrieve corporate records very, very easily. Everyone can, it's public. In Delaware, you cannot. And conducting these investigations helps our understanding a huge amount in understanding these relationships. So at the top there, I'm just scrolling through all of the subsidiaries of AppNexus. As you can see, one company can also be a lot of companies. And at the bottom, there's a graphic from a piece of corporate registration software that shows that they have subsidiary companies all over the world. These companies are truly global. So chasing them can feel quite futile a lot of the time. It can feel a little bit like the scene in Rocky, you know, where he makes him chase the chicken for agility. It's somewhat tragicomic. However, we do build tools that certainly allow users to detect tracking that is going on websites in quite an efficient way. Just as easy as it is for ad tech to create technologies that collect personal data through backdoors, it's also possible to study and reverse engineer their techniques to detect non-compliant use. And part of our job is to put that technology in the hands of regulators so that we can deal with the problem of scale that they have. So as a consultancy, we use our own privacy forensics tool to scan huge volumes of pages, millions of pages, and perform secondary analysis. And we make a free version of this tool, which is available at GitHub, and is available to be used in companies, of course. My business partner has worked really hard to keep that code base up to date and open source, and to maintain it as a contribution to what is now emerging as a privacy industry. And what this tool does is it simulates the visit of a user using Chrome on a list of websites. It actually scrolls through and interacts with the page. But what it doesn't do is click consent banners. And this is very important because it means we're able to see the kind of tracking that's going on pre-consent. It's called rendered user simulation. And another analogy that I'd like to share with you. Perhaps some of you are familiar with programmatic advertising and real-time bidding, which is the way in which ad brokers trade personal information and allow brands to bid on the value of that information. Now, this is a diagram that is created by the Internet Advertising Bureau, so they represent all of the advertisers on the internet. And you can see there's a wonderful, self-disclosed, unaccountable, big black box represented by that X in the middle, which is the exchange, the ad exchange, where the value of an individual personal data profile or a collection of it is negotiated. Now, on the left-hand side, you have the point of collection, which is the publisher's website. And that's where we come in, because several stages on the left-hand side, we can actually capture. We can capture the visit, we can capture the way in which the website collects information on you, and then we can even track it on the traffic analysis to see whether it goes to a specific ad server. And then, unfortunately, after that, it does get a little bit murky. So where it fades to orange, that's where we really require some regulator investigation, first-hand investigation as to how this data is being traded. But one more thing we are doing is to create a search extension for users that consults our own domain ownership list so that when you visit a website, when you search on a search engine, a lot of the time, you know, we're idly researching something and perhaps there are 10 results that to us are more or less the same in terms of the value of the information they're going to provide to us. But if I can just make it a little bit harder for you to visit the one with 100 trackers on the page, that I'd like to do that. So we're releasing a search extension next year in collaboration with search extension Serx, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that allows the user to consult our database with their search results in a way that's entirely private. They're downloading our database using their version of the extension. We don't see any of their search results. In order to make sure they don't need to go on some of the more egregious websites. And this is called Web X-ray Discovery. It queries our scans of the Alexa 1 million websites. And we would like to be able to roll this out to as many search engines as possible. So if anyone has any ideas about how we can go about that, then please do get in touch. And I think with some of these mechanisms, we can help regulators and help users to avoid participating unwillingly in this marketplace. And then something along the lines of Rocky catching that chicken may finally happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Are there questions in the audience? Yeah?
Do you have some insights how much people use your open tool? Or maybe if there are companies that use your tool that you have open source on GitHub?
Yeah, it's quite specialist in its usage at the moment. Recently, a study was performed with Privacy International, an NGO, looking at mental health websites using our tool. Are you looking for numbers or?
Rough numbers.
I'm afraid I couldn't give you them. I'm not sure. A fair amount of people have downloaded it, but I would love to roll it out to more people.
You mentioned that the ordinary internet user could use extensions in the browser, but you said that are not very useful. So if I have now Firefox and I try to install things like Don't Track Me or also Badger and so on, all this, let's say, things you say are not very effective?
No, I'd still certainly recommend using them rather than not using them. But you're always going to be playing a game of catch-up. You're always going to be detecting technologies used to track you after they've been detected. So, yeah. It's an arms race you can't win, is the point that I was making.
So I had one thing you said about this privacy and security, so that privacy fail is actually a security fail, mm-hmm. and you talked a lot of backdoors. Mm-hmm. I mean, what came to my mind was this parallel. Do you know the Magecart groups? So those are people, these are criminal groups who backdoor payment providers. Maybe you've heard of those payment providers where malicious JavaScript was injected.
Of course,
and these, yeah. And these are the Magecart groups, mostly Magecart group 5, which is a really huge group. So I wanted to ask, do you know of any like situations or cases where it has been actually known that those backdoors were used to get information from users, so that there are malicious groups out there who are actually abusing those backdoors, which are not within the ecosystem and they are not in the legal business of selling stuff, but which are actually using the backdoors you talked about? And have there been any like legal cases or investigations into such groups, or has there been nothing?
Well, there have definitely been instances. I think that's where marketplaces like HubSpot have some auditing to protect them. But sorry, when I'm talking about backdoors, I'm talking about the presence of a third-party tracker existing in the page. I wasn't necessarily talking about criminals. I was talking about third parties, as in data brokers and their technologies.
Of course, but like the Magecart group, also they make a supply chain attack, and then they harvest data from other pages which just load something from third parties. Mm-hmm. And they don't check that those scripts have been compromised. And so have there been the same cases with ad companies where someone just hijacked formally legitimate third party, which was then incorporated into many, many other countries, and no one ever checked this third-party script.
Yeah, yeah. You also talking about cross-site scripting, XSS,
maybe,
and stuff like that. There's a whole catalogue of legal cases in relation to that. So, yeah, the Internet Advertising Bureau, they attempted to create a technology that would solve that problem called Safe Frames, and the criminals just found a way around that within a number of weeks, so it's not even advocated anymore. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really pay attention to any one specific case, but, yeah, there were thousands.
Any more questions around here? No? Then I have one last question. So you mentioned the domain company list on a slide previously.
Yeah.
Is this kind of, like, how do you, is this the way you detect which requests belong to which company, and is it collaboratively, like, increased or extended?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the domain ownership list is manually curated. Thankfully, some of Tim's students at Carnegie Mellon University actually have contributed a lot to that. The way in which we have to reconcile these domains is quite painstaking. We don't live in an age anymore with reliable Whois data, for example. So there isn't one single method that always works. There's a lot of manual inspection. Sometimes we have to use techniques such as reverse DNS lookup, for example, maybe you'd be familiar with. But it's technical and tedious and painstaking and important at the same time. That's why we do it. But there is a public version of the domain ownership list where absolutely external people can make comments. I should actually get the URL on screen at some point. Unfortunately, I haven't.
Okay, thank you so much. So if there are no any further questions, thanks so much for that really interesting insights in the ad tech companies. And give another warm applause to our speaker, Paul May.
Thank you.